Well, good day and welcome back to the Johnson Space Center for today's mission status briefing on the flight of Atlantis to the International Space Station. An eventful day on orbit with us to discuss all of the details, the lead space shuttle flight director for STS-135, Kwasi Alaburuho. Kwasi.
Thank you, Rob. We've had an absolutely outstanding rendezvous and docking today. The docking was accomplished with very few issues at all. In fact, we're right on schedule, and the crew has ingressed the International Space Station and is preparing to hand off the orbiter boom sensor system to the space shuttle's robotic arm. The activities of the crew today started with a power-up of the primary flight systems that are required for rendezvous and docking. Now, during that power-up, we did experience a slight problem with one of our general purpose computers, or GPCs. And essentially, it was really just a transient problem that took one of those computers down for the rendezvous, and we had to rendezvous without it, but it represented simply a loss of redundancy. Now, what was going on with the computer is this. When we power up the flight systems for rendezvous and docking, we fly with three redundant computers that do all of the computations of the vehicle's trajectory, assess its attitude, and help us do navigation to guide the space shuttle to a rendezvous and dock with the International Space Station. Now, those computers all talk on the same flight critical data buses, and they listen to those data buses, and ideally, those computers will be seeing and saying the exact same things. And they also talk to each other and compare notes, if you will. And if any one of the computers is outputting something that's different than the others, the majority essentially votes that computer into a failed state. Now, as we're powering up those computers to prepare for the rendezvous and dock, we physically flip a switch in the cockpit that takes the computers that were asleep into an active state. And the switches on those computers have detents that can be a little bit temperamental from time to time. And if you don't decisively and carefully move the switch from one position to the other, there could be a slight rebounding effect that makes the contacts of the switch come off the detent ever so slightly and for the briefest of seconds. That happened with our computer number three as the crew was bringing that computer to an active state. The switch came off the detent for just a split second, but just long enough for the other two computers that were up to see a change in its state and vote that computer to a failed state. We don't think that there's anything physically wrong with the computer, and in fact, we have to load a new software image to it. We're going to try to do that tomorrow at the beginning of the crew's day. So we were able to fly the rendezvous and docking today with two of the three computers that we normally have up. That's perfectly within our flight experience and perfectly within our flight rules. It just represented a loss of redundancy, but we had absolutely no other problems with the spacecraft other than that. An interesting thing for you to note, this exact same problem, the last time it happened was on STS-122, which was also a flight of Atlantis. There were one or two other commonalities between this flight and that flight, which I'll let folks research at their leisure. Again, this we don't think was a symptom of a real hardware problem, and we expect to be able to get this computer back to full functionality here in the next day or so. After we got all of the rest of the systems powered up, the crew got into the rendezvous checklist right on schedule, and they were running very well on the pace the whole day. The actual rendezvous was accomplished with no issues. The crew managed their on-orbit tasking very well, just as they did yesterday during the TPS inspections. And it was an absolutely spectacular sight when Atlantis arrived on the R-bar, which is basically underneath the International Space Station, and began its R-bar pitch maneuver. In fact, we have some video of the R-bar pitch maneuver, which we were able to capture in real time, and we'd be happy to show you. When the space shuttle arrives on the R-bar, the commander sort of pitches upward to begin essentially a backflip, if you will, of the space shuttle. And when it is essentially on its back with its belly facing the International Space Station, the crew on board the space station today, consisting of three crew members, each with a different resolution camera, we'll take high-resolution imagery of the underside of the space shuttle's thermal protection system to assess the physical condition of the tiles to make sure that there was no debris damage on ascent or during its orbital travel to the space station that would present a problem or concern for successful reentry. And so as the shuttle is pitching back, the way you see in the video, there'll be lots of photos, literally hundreds of photos, taken with a high-speed digital camera. Those photos will be downlinked via the space station's communication assets, and then the photos will be assessed by engineering teams, and ultimately within the next few days, hopefully the entire shuttle's thermal protection system will be cleared. And that's about as much of the video as you'll probably want to see, because the rest, of course, is just more of the same. But it really is a spectacular sight. We're very fortunate today with their trajectory. The International Space Station had the high-rate Ku-band communications link during the RPM, so we were able to see that in mission control real-time. It was a very special moment for the flight control team that was watching the fruit of their labors as far as guiding Atlantis to its rendezvous and docking with the space station. And we were very excited to see that. After we completed the rendezvous pitch maneuver, we maneuvered flawlessly to the V-bar, which is essentially directly in front of the International Space Station. And Commander Chris Ferguson guided the spacecraft to an absolutely flawless and very smooth contact and docking at PMA-2, or the pressurized mating adapter number 2. Following that, the docking mechanism was leveraged to drive the hooks in, drive the ring in, so that we got hard mate between Atlantis and the ISS, and then we maneuvered the joint shuttle space station stack back to its nominal torque equilibrium attitude, or the nominal attitude that we will fly for the duration of the mission. At the time I left MCC, we had just opened hatches, and at this hour, the crew of Atlantis is on board the International Space Station participating in a standard safety briefing, and the rest of the day will be spent removing the orbiter boom sensor system from the shuttle's payload bay with the space station robotic arm and handing that off to the space shuttle's robotic arm so that appendage will be out of the way when we prepare to install the MPLM in the morning. And so that's the day's activities so far. So far everything is going very well. And again, just as yesterday, we're not tracking significant problems, just that one issue with the computer, which we think we'll be able to resolve in the morning. And so that's my summary, and I'll be happy to take questions.
Thanks, Kwatsi. We'll take questions here in Houston. We do have a quartet of reporters on the phone bridge as well. So if you could use the floor mic, appreciate it. It's right behind Robert there. And we'll start off with Mark.
Hey, thank you. Mark Corot for Aviation Week. And just a quick question on the GPC. What do you need it to do for the rest of the mission? And I know you used to carry spares. I don't know whether you still do or not. Would you replace it if you do, or can you just work around that?
Okay, great questions. Right now, we do not carry spare GPCs on the shuttle for these missions. It was decided some years ago that with the redundancy that we have five of these computers on board, that it was not necessary for us to carry spares. We have five of them on board so that we can sustain failures and still have sufficient redundancy in the flight critical computations to guide the spacecraft to a safe rendezvous or to a safe entry. So we're not so much concerned about that. Now, as far as what we need to do with the computer from here, when the other computers in what we call the common set, that is essentially the council of computers that look at each other and make sure that everyone's saying the same thing, when the common set essentially votes the anomalous computer out of the set, we, in this instance, given how it happened, we have to essentially reload the computer from the onboard hard drive so that it's got a fresh software image, all of the failure flags and error flags are reset, and so that computer can then participate in operations. So that what we call IPL, initial program load, that process takes about 25 to 30 minutes. We're trying to carve out some time in the crew's day tomorrow morning to get that done. And once we see a successful IPL, we'll probably let that computer run for several hours, and then put it in its sleep mode, which is its normal state during docked ops.
Yes, sir.
Dan Vergano with USA Today. I was wondering if you can talk a little bit about this being the final docking of the shuttle to the space station. Do you still need this particular docking hatch? What it'll be used for in the future? And, you know, can you say a little bit, what were your thoughts knowing that this was the last time this was going to happen with the shuttle?
Okay. Well, as far as the use of the hardware, this particular docking port, the pressurized mating adapter, it was designed to support the APDS system, which is part of the shuttle's orbiter docking system. It's actually of Russian design, so it's designed to be compatible with that hardware. So we won't really use this particular port for a visiting vehicle, certainly not for the foreseeable future. Not for quite a while. So this pressurized mating adapter might be used for a closet, actually, when they're not being used to support the transfer of crew back and forth between the ISS and the space shuttle. Sometimes we do use these pressurized mating adapters to alleviate some of our stowage concerns on board, to store hardware that we don't use as regularly. And so we're thinking about utilizing this pressurized mating adapter for that purpose after the shuttle leaves. Now, with this being the final rendezvous and docking of a shuttle to the space station, I have to say, in my observation, particularly fairly early in our shift, I think everybody on the flight control team was feeling it. You know, on a typical mission, we exercise rendezvous and docking more than we exercise most things in the orbit phase, because it tends to be the most complex series of operations that we do on orbit. And so this is a day that we have rehearsed considerably. We've committed more training time to executing this day well than we have to all of the other objectives. And so this really represented a big game day, if you will, for my team. And so on the one hand, I know we all felt a great sense of excitement and a great sense of anticipation as we came to participate in this highly complex, highly technical, and very precise series of operations. But at the same time, I think it did start to weigh on the team in my perception that it was going to be the last one. And so, again, you know, my team is filled with consummate professionals, some of the best I've ever worked with. And so there was certainly no emotional impediment to good performance today. But I think it's fair to say that the finality of our executing this particular series of operations was felt.
Philip Sloss with NASASpaceflight.com. Could you give us an update on where your cryo margins look today?
Okay, that's a great question. I'd be happy to do that. Right now, we have had a chance to thoroughly assess how the cryo margins are shaping up. The margin of cryogenic oxygen and hydrogen that we have to generate power. And we believe that we are looking at about 1 day, 3 hours above our nominal 12 plus 0 plus 2 day mission. And so if this continues to persist and this amount of margin remains stable, we'll ask the mission management team probably the day after tomorrow on flight day 5 to formally give us permission to extend a day and fill the additional day with other objectives. The reason we're going to wait for another couple of days, you know, there are a variety of things that influence the amount of cryogenics that you can see and extract from the tank. You know, the cryogenic oxygen, hydrogen, it's basically liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen, and a variety of factors, including dynamic motion from attitude maneuvers, rendezvous burns, can cause some of that liquid gas to liquid hydrogen and oxygen to go back and forth between its gaseous state and its liquid state. And so sometimes you may see a decrease in the pressure, which suggests a decrease in quantity. And so there's just some variability in the quantities that we see from time to time. And so over the course of time, these variable transients stabilize, and we're able to assess them statistically and determine that we do have the amount of consumables in the tanks that we believe we do. And so we just want to give ourselves that additional time to make sure that we are comfortable with the margin we have before we commit to use that additional resource.
Just a quick follow to clarify, does that that 1 plus 3 hours include the MPLM shell heaters, that buyback that you were talking about pre-flight?
That revised margin that I quoted you, 1 day, 3 hours, that assumes that we do not power the MPLM heaters in the shuttle payload bay. So basically, this is the margin based on the plan we believe, or excuse me, based on the plan that we are executing. So this is what we think we'll have. So we think we have sufficient margin with the plan that we're on right now to go ahead and extend the mission today. Again, that formal decision won't be made until probably the day after tomorrow, but all of the conditions are aligning to be able to extend the mission by 1 day.
Denise Chow at space.com. Since this will be probably for at least a while, the last time that more than six people will be at the space station at one time, I was wondering if you could speak about the significance of that, and particularly in regard to the importance of this mission to the future of the space station.
Well, this mission is very important to the future of the space station because, you know, as has been reported before, our agency and our country is in the midst of a significant shift in policy when it comes to space exploration, particularly our utilization of space in low Earth orbit. We are now moving into a season where we're attempting to leverage the services of commercial providers who heretofore have not significantly flown people in space. Of course, commercial companies have been flying satellites and other uncrewed tech in space for some time. And so there's a lot that's new about the policy. There's a lot that's new about figuring out how to do operations with the commercial providers. And the commercial providers themselves are developing their space systems and preparing to certify them to carry people. That process is proceeding along a fairly expected trajectory. However, one thing that's absolutely certain in spaceflight is that the job is always going to be harder than it appears to be at first glance. And so the supplies that this crew is bringing to the International Space Station really are sort of insurance. Because once we retire the shuttles, then until we get the commercial providers online or some other regular cargo and crew delivery system online, then we'll be limited in how much we can resupply the International Space Station. So these supplies that we're delivering, as well as the spare parts, which is also very important, will enable us to keep the core systems, to keep the crew, and to keep the research that's ongoing on the space station, ongoing at its nominal planned pace through the end of 2012. And so that's vitally important to the agency, and I think it's critical to the transition in space policy that we're attempting to make. As far as the significance, I know just judging from my observation of the crew, the shuttle crew as they greeted the space station crew, I think the significance of this last visit by a shuttle crew and this last visit by as large a crew to the International Space Station, I know the significance of that is felt by the astronauts on board. You could tell, you could sense a palpable increase in emotion from all of the crew members, not just our U.S. astronauts flying on board the space shuttle, but even our international partner astronauts on the International Space Station. They were extremely happy and really elated to see their visitors. And I know that they really recognize and appreciate the significance of these moments.
More questions here in Houston? If not, we'll go to the phone bridge. Marsha Dunn, you there?
Yes, hi. This is Chris Baltimore with Reuters.
Yes, hi.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, well, hang on, Chris, or we're going to get to you in order, but Marsha Dunn goes first in order.
Sorry. I was wondering I'm wondering what kind of emotions washed over you, Kwatsi, when you saw Atlantis up close for the first time. As it was approaching the space station, since we aren't going to see that too much more.
I'll tell you what was going through my mind. I was really having a number of flashbacks. My very first experience with Atlantis was really as a trainee. The very first time that I saw the operation of Atlantis from Mission Control was my very first year here at NASA in 1995. I was doing some on-the-job training with Shuttle Life Support Systems Officer on STS-71, which was the very first time that a space shuttle has docked with a space station. That was the very first docking of the space shuttle with the space station Mir. And so I found myself, as I was looking at this craft, particularly as it was up close and doing the RPM, thinking about the defining moments in my career here that have been marked by the presence and the flight of this particular space shuttle. And I won't say that I got close to welling up in the eyes, but I will say that it was a powerful moment for me. One obviously that I tried to keep relatively discreet, so as not to be a distraction to the team of flight controllers that I was leading. But I know they were all feeling very similar emotions, thinking about where we've come from, how much we've accomplished in the last 15 plus years for me. And I was not feeling sadness, but just sort of that understandable and common and sober anticipation of what's coming next, of what the transition to the next phase of my career and the next phase of my life will be. That's really what preoccupied my thoughts, other than making sure that my computer problem really was a switch issue and not something more nefarious.
Thank you so much.
Okay, next up in order, Alan Boyle, MSNBC, you there?
Yeah, hi. This is Alan Boyle with MSNBC. I wanted to ask whether docked operations will change the dynamic that you were talking about yesterday, where the four astronauts on the crew have more room, things are more comfortable. How is that going to change now that it's 10 people instead of four?
Well, one of the things that's working for us is the International Space Station is a huge complex, and when you combine that with the space that's in the orbiter, I think there will be plenty of room to operate. I think this crew will continue to be very efficient. For the next several days, the name of the game will be cargo transfer. When you look at downlink video, you're going to see bag upon bag upon bag, moving across the hatches from various stowage locations on the ISS to the orbiter and vice versa. So I think that's really going to dominate the video. I think it'll be like almost like watching an army of ants moving in and out of an anthill carrying their cargo, although the astronauts are obviously considerably bigger. I think the crew will continue to be very efficient. I think we'll make very good use of all crew members on the International Space Station. There will be a break in the transfer. The transfer operations for us to do the spacewalk on flight day 5, and so there'll be considerable focus on making sure that goes well. I think given that we are still going to end up having fewer crew members on the both spacecraft than we've had on the preceding missions, we will see some efficiencies gained just by virtue of the fact that you're tripping over fewer people, if you will. But at the same time, we'll be sort of making up a relative deficit of crew power with fewer people. So I think after all said and done, we're going to stay on the timeline, maybe get a little bit ahead. This crew obviously is proving themselves to be incredibly capable. So my money's on us being able to accomplish just a little bit more than we even thought we would.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, now on to you, Chris Baltimore from Reuters.
Yes, thank you. Chris Baltimore from Reuters, and apologies for jumping the gun. Just another quick question on the GTC. If you could let us know what the flight parameters are for how many of those computers need to be operational for the shuttle to be able to continue its operations, and just so I can understand how this works, there are five of these computers on board, and three of them are running in tandem at any given time. Is that correct?
Okay, it's a great question. Let me summarize data processing systems 101 for you, and I'll try not to bore anyone. Typically, during ascent and entry, which are arguably the most complex and critical phases of flight, we have all five computers up in a redundant set. all looking and looking at the same buses, monitoring the same buses, and talking to each other to make sure that they essentially all agree in their calculations, because arguably during ascent and during entry, the atmospheric parameters that have to be managed by the flight control system, as well as the engine performance and attitude control, all of that has to be done by computer, because the parameters change faster than any human being could really manage in piloting. And so we have five of them running at the same time. The idea is that we could sustain a failure of two of them and still have a quorum to vote, if you will. As long as you have three computers, you know, you could take a failure of one of them and the two others could vote that computer out. So five computers is really massively redundant, if you will, and we feel we require that redundancy for ascent and entry. Now, of those five computers, one of the computers runs a completely different version of the software that was designed to a different specification and run and coded by a different software provider. That's our backup flight system to guard against a endemic and insidious software issue that would affect the other four computers. So that's generally what we do. Now, for on-orbit operations, particularly rendezvous and docking, because our rendezvous and docking burns that we do are often critical. They're critical from a trajectory perspective and critical from a timeline perspective. We like to fly with three of those computers in a redundant set, again, so that we have enough redundancy to where we could take one or two failures and still have a functioning computer to fly by. Now, in the instance that we had today where we lost one of those computers, it simply took away some of our redundancy, and so we just called that our first failure, if you will, and continued to fly on the two computers that we had up. Now, during docked phases like where we are right now, we typically only have one GNC computer up, and then another computer that does our systems management functions for environmental control, thermal control, that sort of thing. So right now we've got no impact to orbiter functionality. If on the off chance this computer does not come back, if GPC-3 does not come back as we expect it to, then that represents essentially a notable loss of redundancy for entry. We can still perform a safe entry, but it's just one of those things that we'll have to identify sooner rather than later, so that the entry flight director, Tony Sakachi, can start talking about that and examine any changes to procedures to the entry, deorbit and entry procedures that we might need to look at.
Okay, just to follow up and not to get too carried away with contingencies, what if you lose another one after that? How does that affect your procedures?
Losing two computers prior to entry is, again, a significant and notable loss of redundancy. You know, we'd have to assess each situation as it arose, try to understand what the failures are. But from a physical data processing capability perspective, the shuttle can re-enter with three computers and re-enter safely. But again, you know, the thing that would be of great concern to us is understanding the nature of the failure. Losing two computers in a single flight is highly unlikely. And of course, when you're talking about computers, you want to examine whether or not there's, again, some systemic software issue or some systemic operating systems issue that might affect multiple computers as opposed to just a discrete hardware failure.
Thank you very much for your patience.
You're more than welcome.
Okay, and Todd Halverson from Florida Today.
Todd Halverson, Florida Today. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we sure can, Todd.
Okay. I just was wondering if the shuttle could re-enter safely with only one GPC operating properly. And just to make sure I understand the flight rule, if you were to lose three, I guess you would have to come home at the next opportunity. What's the flight rule on GPCs? Thanks.
I think you've got the big picture correct. If we lose more than two computers, we consider that a significant loss of redundancy that has safety implications to to the crew. We would be looking at coming home at earliest opportunity. I don't have the flight rule in front of me, Todd, so I'm not gonna profess to quote it from memory, although I think you've captured the spirit of what's in that rule.
Okay, thanks. And just to clarify, the shuttle is capable of landing safely on one GPC. Thanks.
Theoretically, it is certainly capable of landing on one GPC. That's absolutely a situation that we would never, ever want to be in, to have to re-enter on one computer. But again, you know, one computer is capable of driving all of the flight critical buses. It's designed to do that. We have five, so that they can all five drive the flight critical buses in tandem with redundancy. But having only one computer, you can land the spacecraft. It's not at all the situation that we would want to be in, but it is possible.
Thanks. That's all from me, Rob.
Okay. Thanks, Todd. Back here in Houston, any follow-ups, Gina?
Gina Sinceri, ABC News. Have you had a situation in the past where you've lost more than one GPC that you know of?
You know, I can't recall off the top of my head, at least not, certainly not since I've been flight director, have we lost more than one GPC. And at least, you know, within the last several years, our experience with these computers is that they've been very reliable. Most of the problems we've had have been the exact situation we had today, which we affectionately call a switch tease. Where the switch backs off the detent for a split second, and the computer gets failed out of the common set, but I'd have to get you an answer as far as if we've had real hardware failures in the distant past, but certainly not in the recent past.
Anything else? Okay, seeing no further questions, we'll wrap it up. A reminder, as this briefing is ongoing, the mission management team has begun its daily meeting. Over in the control center, the chair of the MMT, Leroy Kane, who's the deputy shuttle program manager, will be here at 3 p.m. Central Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, to conduct his MMT briefing. Atlantis's crew and the station crew will be heading to bed in about 5 hours or so, just before 6 p.m. Central Time. Our flight day three highlights, including all of that spectacular video of the R-bar pitch maneuver, and the docking and the hatch opening and everything that has followed will begin to air at 8 p.m. Central Time tonight and will be replayed every hour on the hour throughout the crew's sleep period. The shuttle station crews will be awakened just before 2 a.m. Central Time, and tomorrow, of course, is the heavy hauling of the Raffaello Multipurpose Logistics Module to get cargo operations underway, which is the crux of this mission. You can follow all the activities on both the shuttle and the station on our website at www.nasa.gov. Until then, we'll see you back here at 3 o'clock for the MMT briefing. Thanks a lot.